There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to Justice, with me, prison philanthropist, and founder of One Small Thing, Edwina Grosvenor. In the final episode of our series exploring motherhood in the justice system, I speak with Lily Lewis again to reflect on what we've heard and the solutions to some of the challenges we've explored this series. We look at what else is needed, such as continued campaigning on these issues and building community alternatives to custody that keep mothers and children together. Importantly, we discuss the evidence we hope to gather through our Hope Street pilot with evaluation lead Emma Pluggey at the University of Southampton. And finally, we look forward with hope that the justice system can be reformed to better support mothers and their children. It gives me great pleasure to welcome back Lily Lewis onto the podcast to discuss her thoughts and feelings on what she's heard throughout this series and where she thinks we should go next as a sector in improving support for mothers. So Lily, it's great to have you back on the podcast. And today we are going to have a chat about the motherhood series that has just been recorded. And I was really interested to hear your views on, you know, quite a lot of different themes came up. But was there anything that surprised you particularly out of this series, given your experiences?
Yeah, I think I was surprised and not surprised at the same time. But the area of childcare resettlement rattle really stood out to me. And after listening to the podcast, I went away and did a bit more research, because I remember when I first went into prison, my senior officer asked, was I the primary carer before prison, which I wasn't. And she said, oh, that's such a shame, because if you had have been, we could get you out on childcare resettlement. So obviously I didn't think much about that from that conversation, because I knew it wouldn't apply to me. But when I was a Samaritan's listener, I did work with women who were trying to access this and were finding it really difficult. So when I've looked at the actual ruling around this, I found out that if you have a child and you were the primary carer and they were up to the age 16, I'm not sure why that wasn't 18, but it's 16, that you are eligible immediately for childcare resettlement rattle. There is no eligibility date. So from day one of your sentence, you could apply for this. It would initially start with days out, but you could actually have a one night or one period every 28 days of a night stay with your child or children.
I didn't know much about this at all. And I sort of thought, God, I've spent years working in women's prisons, and it's amazing how much one doesn't know, even when you're really close to it. That's a legal requirement, are we saying?
Yeah, so that's from the PSI or the PSO. Unless you, because we know that women's prisons, we have open or closed. So if you were classified A, so you were a lifer or a serious crime, you wouldn't be entitled to this. But anybody other is. And I don't know one woman in the 4 years I was in prison that was aware of that.
I do remember Kate Lill from Prison Advice Service. I think that was the second episode of the podcast, if anyone wants to listen back. She touches on this, but it's really interesting that so few people know about it. And certainly it's not happening in the way it should. And it also seems that staff have no idea in the main.
I don't know whether they don't have any idea or it would create a lot of work, because imagine all these women would have to be risk assessed. And from an if you're in a closed prison such as Stile, Foston, Drake, it would take a lot of management to get these women out and in. So I understand that. But I just think it's so sad and unfortunate that so many women would have been able to have had the benefit of this, and children as well. Let's not just think about mum, that the children would have had the benefit of seeing mum and overnight stays from very early on in the sentence.
So that's quite interesting in the sense that if it's a legal requirement, then obviously there is the service's duty bound to provide it. So if someone was to mount a legal challenge around it, now there's all sorts of reasons why women won't and why women can't, but that leaves a bit of a question mark, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is what would be interesting to me, to see if women were, if any other women were aware of it or have been offered it, or it was just the women that I came across. But I'd been in so many prisons and I didn't know any women going out early on in their sentence to see children. So I can't see that I would have missed that.
That's really interesting. To be continued. That's another thing that one small thing can pick up on. Was there anything that particularly either changed your mind about things or changed your perspective or any thoughts and feelings that came out of the series for you?
Yeah, I think for me, when I was listening to Laura Abbott, the In Pregnancy in Prison Part 1, she made a statement that when she left the prison gate, she had this feeling of relief. And she describes prison as being tense and brutal. And that was something that really awakened my memory. When I left prison, eventually left for good, was released and was away from prison and the prison gates, I remember thinking how tense and brutal my life had been for the 4 years. And I think while you're in there, it's not something you're as aware of as when you're out. But I just found it really interesting that somebody that was able to come in and go out freely would still have them similar feelings. And it just elevates it even more, how brutal and tense a prison environment is.
I suppose it's a bit of a survival mechanism, isn't it? When you're experiencing something bad, I guess we sort of close down, don't we? And you just have to get through it. And it's not until you're out the other side that you go, oh my God, did that just happen?
Yeah, I think for me, whenever I saw anybody that seemed in crisis or really emotional, it was seen as a weakness by most of the other prisoners. So you become hardened to your own emotion, because to show emotion or sadness or weakness, you would then be targeted. So I think you do have the shield around you to protect yourself.
Mm. And on the podcast here, on the Justice Podcast, we always try and think about the solutions and the things that give people hope, because all the subjects are quite deep, aren't they, and can be upsetting. So was there anything sort of within this series that made you sort of think, great, you know, there are some solutions out there. What can we all be championing? And anyone who's listening that's in a position of influence or, you know, what is it that stood out for you?
I think all different women, we all came from different backgrounds and we all had different experiences. But I think the thing that came out clear was that we all felt that there should be another option for women. Everybody had that same undertone that actually we need to be looking at places like Hope Street and community rehabilitation. Every single person on the podcast would say that same thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly the police that I speak to, members of the judiciary, some of them, it seems to be a sort of general consensus. It's just trying to keep pushing, isn't it, for it to become the norm. Did people talk about solutions that you think could work particularly? Because, of course, what annoys me so much is that we have these solutions, we know what it is we need to do, but it's just trying to get it done and trying to get these sort of solutions, you know, rolled out, really, isn't it? So was there anything in particular that you thought, right, if we ran with that, that would make a significant difference?
Yeah, I think the social workers, when I was listening to their podcast, I thought that it was a great idea and a great pilot that they are inside women's prisons. And it almost seems it should be a given that if we've got women in prison with children who are under social care or social services, that we should have somebody that we can liaise with within those prison walls. And I think that was the hardest thing for me, because I had two children in foster care, is that I had to go through the social worker for any communication. And trying to get through to a social worker on a prison phone is really difficult. So it just makes sense that if there had been a social worker that was available, I'm sure lots of women would have took advantage of that to find out what was happening with the children and arrange contacts and just to have that easier communication.
Yeah, and when you think about, you know, yes, that would be a cost to the service, but quite frankly, it's something that needs to be done. And the benefits would outweigh the cost that goes in, surely. You know, to be able to have someone who can do that admin, who can make those calls, who can liaise with women, that's when you see the self-harm coming down. That's when you see the behaviour improving. Everyone in the prison, therefore, is having a better time. You know, it's just so...
Yeah, it just seems... Yeah, so obvious. And I think as well, when we're looking at women who are maybe pregnant and then their children will go out of the prison, again, that would be a much smooth, even as difficult or hard as it may be, it may make that transition a lot easier if you've got somebody within the prison that can help you and support you with that.
What would you want anyone who has been listening to the podcast to take away from the series, do you think, in particular?
I think it's the same thing that I talk about a lot, is that we do need to see a change. And we talk about this and we've been talking about this for years and years, but we need to be protecting women who are pregnant and who are entering into the criminal justice system. And we need to be asking the question, when is it right for a pregnant woman to be in prison in a cell? And just women in general, regardless of with or without children, we need to be looking at how women are when they come out and the trauma that is embedded into you from spending time in prison, whether it be a short time or a long term. And just, I think we all need to pull together and make those changes.
Yeah, I'd agree. I mean, I think for me, having interviewed all these people and sort of being sat in the middle, being able to listen to everyone talking and from so many different points of view, it's difficult, I guess, for listeners who haven't worked in this space and are maybe learning about it. Maybe listeners haven't been into a prison, maybe they don't know any prisoners and haven't been able to talk to them. But I always think it's worth trying to put yourself in the shoes of someone. So if you're a woman listening who has been pregnant, try and imagine actually what that would be like if you're locked in your cell. You can't eat the food that you need to eat. You can't eat the amount that you need to eat. You might be feeling sick like I did every single day of my pregnancy. You know, you're hot, you're cold, you've got itchy legs. There's all sorts of weird things going on with you when you're pregnant. To be able to try and really imagine what that's like and put yourself in the shoes of others is probably the most important thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I think when I talk to people about it, I do say that go and sit in the bathroom, shut the door and just imagine you can't get out and see how long it is before you want to get out. And it's seconds, not even minutes for most people, because when they thought that they can't get out, they want to get out more. And I think unless you've been in that position, it's so hard to even explain what that's like. You're literally in a box and you can't get out. I thought that when we went through COVID that we might have learned a lot of lessons through that, when women would have been locked up more, but we're yet to see some changes, I guess.
Well, Lily, thank you so much. I think having your expertise and your experiences woven through this series has made it really, really impactful, because people can't argue with those who've experienced it firsthand. And as I've said before, and I'll say again, I often get people saying to me with slight disbelief about some of the things I talk about when it comes to women in prison, because quite a lot of it is actually quite unbelievable, if we're going to be honest. So I just want to say thank you so much. It's hard going over all these things, I know. So thank you so much for your expertise and your time.
No, thank you for letting me be part of this and hopefully part of the change. Thank you.
Looking to the future, it's really important that we continue to work together across the sector to campaign for reform. One example of this is the No Birth Behind Bars campaign, which Naomi and Sam from Birth Companion spoke about in a previous Justice episode.
We're focusing not just on improving standards of care, you know, in custody, but on the really important issue that you both raised, which is sort of sentencing, working upstream to stop women getting into custody in the first place. On the issue of mother and baby units, as Sam says, they can be helpful for some women, you know, with the level of care perhaps that's available that they wouldn't get elsewhere. But actually, there is a better way. There is an alternative way, and that should be giving women and children the care they need in the community.
You know, the campaign for not putting pregnant women behind bars is still ongoing. I mean, you know, in an ideal world, they would say tomorrow, you know, pregnant women shouldn't be behind bars and they should instead look at community-based sentences. And I would hope that, you know, that is going to happen sometime in the near future. But I think for now, like, the work that I mainly do with Birth Companions on trying to make some changes, I think things are happening slowly. But, you know, again, on the point, you can make changes, but you're still putting a pregnant woman and a child behind a locked door inside a prison. So, you know, that's never going to be all right. That's never going to be safe.
Next, we speak to Emma Pluggy, who is the lead at the University of Southampton for our evaluation of Hope Street. Hope Street aims to be a safe and viable community alternative to custody for women who would otherwise be imprisoned unnecessarily on short sentences, often due to a lack of safe accommodation or concerns around their well-being. The project brings accommodation for women and their children together with trauma-informed support and access to services through a 24-hour hub. Hope Street has been purpose-built and specifically designed by and for women to create a welcoming home environment, designed with communal as well as private spaces, an on-site creche and play areas for children. As well as influencing and campaigning, action is needed to show that there is another way to treat women and their children. We hope that Hope Street can be a blueprint for change across the entire justice system.
I'm Emma Pluggy. I'm a public health trained doctor and a researcher at the University of Southampton. And I'm one of the leads, along with Professor Julie Parks, who's leading the team who will be evaluating the Hope Street project.
Which is super exciting. Could you explain a little bit about the evaluation? And of course, this evaluation is 5 years, isn't it? It's a big one.
It's a big one in many ways, not just for the length of time, the 5 years, but I think the nature of it, the complexity of it and what we're trying to capture. So thinking about the evaluation, I think the most important thing that we're trying to capture is what is the impact on the women who are going to Hope Street? What's the impact on them as individuals, but also their families? Because obviously the idea that the children can stay with them potentially is such an important part of the whole evaluation. Of the whole project. So we're going to be looking at the impact in the broadest terms. So obviously I'm a health researcher and we'll be looking at health outcomes, which are very important for these women, but much more broadly than that, looking at their social outcomes in terms of relationships, their employment, their housing, you know, the absolute fundamentals of I suppose, hopefully, a happy and healthy existence for them. And of course, looking at criminal justice outcomes as well. So their contact with the criminal justice once they're in system, once they're in Hope Street, but also trying to look at the impact on their families as well, their children who are in Hope Street, but perhaps more broadly than that. And we want to see how these things change as they go through Hope Street and into the Hope houses across Hampshire, and hopefully into their own secure housing at the other end.
It sounds really multifaceted. Is that unusual for an evaluation to be so sort of multi-layered?
Probably the short answer is yes. I think very often more and more we see that sort of health and social care are linked. But this has another sort of dementia in terms of the contact with the criminal justice system. And in sort of health research speak, we're evaluating what's known as a complex intervention, which is Hope Street. And I think not only are the outcomes multifaceted, you know, complex, and we're going to have to capture lots, but we need to understand what's going on. So we're going to have to sort of capture all the many facets of Hope Street. I mean, you know, what is it that leads to the change? If there are positive changes, potentially negative changes, we need to find explanations for those. So we've really got to understand what's going on at Hope Street in terms of the sort of trauma-informed care, you know, how the relationships within Hope Street and the built environment, you know, there are so many parts to it. So we're going to have a real challenge. It'll be very exciting to look at all those facets as well.
And what about the balance between the qualitative entity of it and the quantitative? Because in my mind, one shouldn't have one without the other. And these things are balanced. But of course, we know some people are much more data driven and much more interested in that. I see the point, you know, that's obviously valuable data, but the stories are important and there's sort of more qualitative elements. How does the evaluation kind of stack up in that sense?
Yeah, well, we're definitely going to be using both qualitative and quantitative methods. And I agree with you. I don't think you can have one without the other. I think, you know, we've got a very strong health economics strand to it. And we're going to be producing a lot of numbers in terms of changes in women's mental, physical, social well-being and contact with the criminal justice system, because I think policymakers are going to, they want to see the numbers. They want to see the numbers. And so we will be producing those. But equally, I think we need to understand what's behind the numbers. And you can only do that with the qualitative work. And so we have got a really powerful qualitative strand, I think, not least because we have people with lived experience who will be leading that. And not only that, we will be developing our team as time goes on, because what we want to do is actually train women in Hope Street who are interested in becoming researchers to actually become part of the research team. And they will be undertaking qualitative research. So we want to definitely have a very strong qualitative element whilst appreciating at the same time that the policymakers like the numbers.
And is that a first for you, bringing women on sort of incrementally as an evaluation evolves? Is that something that's normal?
It's not something that's usual. I'm increasingly, it's interesting, I've sort of been in this field, 15, 20 years working with women in contact with the criminal justice system. When I started out, there was barely any sort of nod to these women, which now looking back seems utterly bizarre. But increasingly these days, it's not just a question of being convinced of their value. I think it's just it being a must do now if you secure funding. I think it's really understanding how important it is, and having seen how, actually having lived experience in a research project, how it transforms it, actually.
And Hope Street is a 5-year pilot. You'll be with Hope Street during that time. And then is there a sort of a big unveil at the end of this is what we found, or how will that work?
Well, we hope to be reporting our findings sort of certainly at least on an annual basis. But I think, we will be working with Hope Street to put things out there as soon as we find important and interesting findings. So it won't be the big unveil at 5 years. However, I think in terms of numbers, we're reaching statistical significance, we're back to what the powers that be want to see, it might be that it's going to take all of those 5 years to get the numbers, sufficient numbers up. And because actually we want this to be the best evaluation there has been, the most robust, and this is about producing robust evidence.
And do we have a comparison group?
We absolutely have an imprisoned comparison group at the moment, or we will have, making preparations for that. But also with thinking of looking to develop a community comparison group, so women who are on probation potentially in the community. But I think we've got to see who's coming in to Hope Street in those first 6 months, reflect on that, take stock and think, right, these are the women who are going to make the most convincing best comparison group.
Exactly. And I think another really important part is the economics, right? And is this cost effective? Are there better outcomes? You know, those are two things that we're really looking for, isn't it? And that's not to say that something like Hope Street should or could be done on the cheap, because quite frankly, when you do that, they don't work as well. But actually, is there a good cost effectiveness, good outcomes? I guess you're looking at all of that too.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're so lucky to have Professor James Raftery on as a member of the team, who is so engaged with this and so enthusiastic about looking at this. The core team is sort of numbers about 10 at the moment. But as I said, the exciting thing is it's going to be getting bigger, we hope, as we train the Hope Street women as they come through, and they will join our team. I think it's characterised by diversity and breadth, the breadth of experience and expertise. So if we start with the people with lived experience, so we've got Paula Harriet, who leads involvement at the Prison Reform Trust. She's a co-op along with EPIC. So EPIC are an organisation that have people with lived experience working for them, and lots of experience working with women, training women up with lived experience to become researchers. So that's really exciting. Then we've got a whole university-based team. We've got another Donna, our wonderful research fellow, who's very much full-time on this project, who comes from more sociological background, her training. We've got Professor Kathy Kendall, who trained in criminology, Sarah Morgan, an epidemiologist, James Hall, whose particular expertise is in children, so that's great, and of course myself, and James Raftery, a health economist. So a huge breadth of different disciplines and expertise and experience, but I think one of the key things that we have always been very clear about is the value of the sort of knowledge and understanding generated by perhaps the university people, you might say, that you know, our numbers and what have you, is of equal value to that generated by the people with lived experience and expertise by experience.
Yeah, fantastic. And you will plan to be on site, will you, once a week? How does that work? How do you get alongside these women who, you know, will come from these different backgrounds and circumstances? How do you intend to sort of seamlessly get into the team and the women and kind of, you know, ask what might be prying questions in a sort of sensitive environment?
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, I think we need to be very much become regular visitors, if you like, sort of known faces there. And Donna will definitely be coming down at least once a week. But I think we want to be seen as just other people wandering around, you know, very much there.
And then finally, it's 5 years. So when did you start and when does the 5 years come to an end?
So officially it really started about a year ago. So in the early part of 2022, when we started gathering sort of routine data on the criminal justice system and making preparations, the 5 years comes to an end. I think it's the end of March 2027.
Which feels quite soon. I can't believe that time has passed already.
Yeah, no, nor can I. And it's racing upon us. And well, just really looking forward to it. But I think, you know, we've got to have an eye on the future the whole time in terms of securing more funding and, you know, thinking creatively as well about, you know, could we be doing some very imaginative, creative work with the children, following them up longer term to see that the outcomes are there. I mean, realistically, 5 years is no time at all.
We don't want to be in a position, do we, later on down the line going, oh gosh, perhaps we should have started doing that thing with the children, because before you know it, 10 years has passed. And as you say, there's such a lack of data and evaluation out there that this really is such an opportunity. So if there are any interested funders listening, then, you know, I'm sure you're open to a conversation, aren't you, Emma?
Very open to a conversation. And I think, you know, I think let's highlight the children. I mean, the children of people who've been in prison, particularly women, in terms of really hard policymaker convincing data, it's just not there. It's just not there. There is stuff there. We know it's not, you know, it's potentially has huge, huge damage to the children. And I think that's an area we've really got to look at. I mean, we don't actually know how many children are out in the community who have an imprisoned parent. You know, they're literally, they're not counted.
It's disgraceful. Well, there's much work to do. So wishing you and the team at Southampton University all the luck in the world with it. And thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your time. Thank you.
Finally, I would like to send a huge thanks to all of the amazing guests that have come on this series of the Justice Podcast. It has been fascinating for me to record. People have been generous with their time, their expertise, and so many people sharing personal experiences with us. So thank you to all of you. Please do go back and listen to other episodes if you've not done so yet. And we really hope that the voices and learning we have collated can really help to move us forward in our mission to redesign the justice system for women and their children.
Links relevant to this episode can be found in the pod notes below. If you enjoyed listening, we would love it if you would subscribe. Also rate, review, and best of all, share this episode. Justice is produced for One Small Thing by the London Podcast Company.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.